Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us. And we're about to have a conversation on the death penalty. First, let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. For the fifth year in a row, Maryland's public schools have been named number one in the country by Education Week magazine. Visit MarylandEducators.org to explore what it means to invest in our students, school construction and safety, and the educators' programs and services that make our schools a national leader. That's MarylandEducators.org for the Maryland State Education Association. One of the hottest debates going on in Annapolis, clearly, is whether or not we should end the death penalty in the state of Maryland. The conversation we've had on this air, on the show, for the last 20 years. We've been covering the death penalty, from interviewing folks on death row to having conversations with people for and against the death penalty. And we are going to wrestle that today with five very interesting guests who I'll introduce in just a moment. But two people who are opposed to death penalty are Sister Helen Prejean and Delegate Heather Mazier. We interviewed them and wanted to give you a snippet of that conversation with them that we had earlier. And then we'll come right back to our guests and wrestle with this very important subject. Welcome, everyone, and our conversation today about capital punishment and the future of it in the state of Maryland. We have with us on the phone Delegate Heather Mazier, of course, from the 20th District, Montgomery County, who's at the forefront of a lot of social and economic justice issues in the House. And she has with her Sister Helen Prejean, who's been on the show numerous times, works on the Death Penalty Discourse Network of New Orleans, and wrote the book The Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, and, of course, Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty, which was one of the great books that sparked an international dialogue. And Sister Helen Prejean and Delegate Heather Mazier, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you. Mark. Great to be here, Mark.
So let me ask each one of you this. Delegate Mazier, let me start with you, just a political question. What do you think is going to happen this time? Are we going to be able to have a death penalty ban, but one that doesn't require life without parole? Do you think that is part of the bargain?
I think we've got the votes lined up to do a death penalty repeal and replace it with life without parole. And for those who say, well, what's different this go around? It's all about the 2012 election. We saw voters of Maryland affirm a desire for equal opportunities and protections under the law for everyone. And it has really created a path for another victory for fairness and justice in our move to abolish the death penalty. We brought together a coalition that crossed faith, political, racial, and economic boundaries when we passed the DREAM Act and marriage equality. And that similarly strong alliance has emerged to make sure that we put an end to the death penalty in Maryland.
And Sister Helen, go ahead, Sister Helen.
The only way democracy works is the education of the people. And on social issues, that's what you got to do. And it's not just in Maryland, but across the country, we see people backing away from the death penalty now. I mean, even in Texas, that used to give out 48 death sentences a year, it's down to 2. Even in the deep South states that are the actual practitioners of the death penalty, the death penalty is waning. And here in Maryland, definitely. I mean, I just got to hear the governor's state of the state. And when he came to the death penalty, he said, we got to recognize what things don't work, and we have to put them aside, and that are very costly and keep us from doing other things.
And Sister Helen, did you speak?
No.
You
no, we're talking about the governor giving the state.
No, I know that, but
I'm
did you speak?
I'm speaking to you, Mark. That way we get to the people. I'm talking to you. Well, isn't that how we get it out to the people?
That's it. That's exactly how we do it, Sister.
Every day feeling like we're getting closer and closer to the secured number of votes necessary in both the House and the Senate to bring this bill to the governor's desk. And we've all come to understand that the death penalty doesn't make us safer, it doesn't save us money, it doesn't work, and it can't be fixed. And that's why we're working so hard to erase it off of Maryland's books. We'll be the 18th state to do it when we do. And I want Sister Helen to tell the listeners what call she's going to make to Rome when we win this one.
Yeah, no. You know, In the last 5 years, every year, New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, Illinois, Connecticut ended the death penalty. And now Maryland's going to do it. And every time a state ends the death penalty, they light up the Roman Colosseum in Rome. It's the oldest symbol of state killing in the world. So Maryland is going to light up the Colosseum, and it's going to be held aloft before the world as another state that has come on board in terms of human rights and ending violence as a way, a legitimate way, to try to end social problems.
Well, I Sister Helen Prejean, let me just say I appreciate all the work you've done and the moral force you've been. And Delegate Heather Mazier, I want to thank you for always being a delegate, a woman to stand up and say what has to be said, and that we are on one more step towards a more humane society. And I want to thank both of you, Delegate Heather Mazier and Sister Helen Prejean, for being with us and for the fight you made. Well, that was a conversation we had earlier, clearly a much more partisan discussion about the death penalty with two women who have been fighting against it for a long time. Sister Helen Prejean has been a guest on the show many times over the years, and I just had a little fondness for her in my heart, just even if it's just her accent. But we are going to wrestle with it from all sides in the course of this hour, because it's a very critical issue that we face here to decide in the state of Maryland. We are joined this hour by Hassan Giordano, who is a host for Reporters Roundtable, an independent journalist with Baltimore's Independent Examiner, Jane Henderson, Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Against State Execution. MD Case is the acronym for that organization. John Bressler is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore, author of Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty, and the Founders' Eighth Amendment and Kiss of Death, America's Love Affair with the Death Penalty. John Cassley, who has been a guest on the show many times. He's the Harford County State's Attorney, a leading advocate for the death penalty. And Delbert Tibbs is with us. He's a former death row inmate, poet, writer, activist, assistant director of membership and communications for Witness to Innocence. And everyone, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you
for having me.
So we have here, I see that everybody's not here just yet, but we are getting them online. John Cassley was here. Is Attorney Cassley here, State's Attorney? Oh, he was, but let's try to get him back. Hassan's with us. Hassan Giordano's with us. John Bessler's with us. And Delbert Tibbs is with us. And Delbert, I knew you joined us the last second. I appreciate you taking the time.
No problem.
Delbert, let me just start this way. I want just way of introduction before we jump into the heart of the subject. Delbert, just for our listeners who don't know you, tell us a bit about your story and the years you spent on death row and what happened to you.
Well, I was arrested in 1974 for crimes of rape and murder in the state of Florida, and was innocent and said that from the very beginning. And there was no evidence to link me to the case except the person who survived, the young woman who survived, said that initially she gave a description of another person who didn't bear any resemblance to me, except we're both African-American males. And later she changed her mind, or she was encouraged to change her mind, and she identified me as a person. That was the only, I can't call it evidence, but that was the only contention that the state could make. Well, she said that he was the person who committed the crime. And I went to trial after 9 months. I was found guilty by an all-white jury. Some people say, well, what difference does it make? Well, it does make a difference, especially in the South and in most other places as well in the USA. And I was sentenced to death. And I spent 3 years on death row in Florida before the case was reviewed by the Florida Supreme Court, who overturned the conviction based on lack of evidence or insufficiency of evidence. But they allowed the state the option of retrying me, which I thought was sort of a novel thing for them to do. And so for the next 5 years, I fought a rear guard action against the state of Florida not to be retried. My case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And finally, in 1982, the prosecutor dropped the case because he said his witness, he didn't think his witness would be creditable to a jury. And since that time, I've been an abolitionist. I've fought for the death penalty. I'm glad to see really think that the state of Maryland would do herself proud by abolishing the death penalty. We, those states that maintain the death penalty are in the same league with Iran and China and some of the Saudi principalities. And we in the U.S. of A. Tout ourselves as a beacon for the world and so forth and as a Christian nation. And I think it's just for us to continue to do it is untenable. It does not serve one single issue regarding crime or regarding the quality of life. And I think most people would agree with that.
So let me bring another guest in here. And Hassan, what were the arguments for you for the death penalty? I mean, just let me outline that. We're waiting for Joe Cassidy to join us, and he'll give you some backup, I'm sure. Go ahead, Hassan.
Well, first of all, thanks, Mark, for having me on. I apologize I'm not in the studio yet and running around to pick up my son and everything. And I do want to say, you know, I have a lot of admiration and respect, especially for Jane Henderson and people who've been fighting this since I've been in the legislature with Delegate Marriott. And my thoughts on this have evolved because I was one of those that said, you know what, the capital punishment in Maryland is not needed. It needs to be abolished. And at that time, I thought, and I still believe that at that time, based off the fact we saw that the system was geared towards African-Americans, especially coming out of Baltimore County. But over and over again, once I had a son, my mind evolved, and my thought, Mark, was, and I kept saying this until a friend kind of corrected me, I said, well, if somebody killed my son, they better hope they lock him up before I get a hold of him because I'm going to be the one that's going to jail. And so she said, well, how can you be against the death penalty if you're ready to do that if somebody took your loved one? And so I had to think about it and say, well, you know what, that's the case. And in 2009, I fought hard with them to get the measures in place that we have now, and it's not as if this is happening on a regular occurrence, Mark. Matter of fact, we have a de facto moratorium as it speaks. Five people have been executed since 1976, since I've been born. And with the measures that have been put in place in 2009, the question it then begs the question, if you kill a child and then they go to jail, they have no reason to believe that they get anything besides life without parole. Your mindset then is you can't do anything to me. So what stops them then from killing correctional officer after correctional officer? You have scared straight that comes into the prison system to kill one of them, and then where do we stand? So the problem isn't, you know, the death penalty in and of itself is, let's begin to address the measures. Again, five people since 1976, but in my city, 200 to 250 people a year get killed on the streets. How do we then focus that energy to stop those killings as opposed to focus on something I don't really, honestly don't think is a problem at this time?
So let me bring another guest in here, and John Bessler. I mean, who's written the books Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty, and The Founder's Eighth Amendment, Kiss of Death, America's Love Affair with Death Penalty, also associate professor of the University of Baltimore. Good to have you with us again, John. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So talk a bit about what you heard Hassan saying. I mean, because the issue of the death penalty becomes, A, an emotional argument, but it also is an argument about whether it is a deterrent or not and how it's used.
Sure. I think that the debate in the United States has really evolved from one about focused on whether it's a deterrent in terms of one of a human rights issue. And the studies on the deterrence are really just don't show that the death penalty is any better deterrent than life without parole. And I think you've got to compare the alternatives. And when, you know, you look at the issue, you look at who has the death penalty. Europe is essentially a death penalty-free zone at this point. You have, you still have 33 states that have the death penalty in the United States, but in a lot of those states, the death penalty is really dormant. It's really not being used. You know, it hasn't been used in Maryland in a long time. California had many years similar to Maryland, has not used the death penalty. So you see a lot of places where it's just simply not used, and really it becomes then really just an arbitrary form of punishment. And under the law, after the ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868, we require equal protection of the law. And if you're just executing people sort of at random, and there's all these errors in the system, and there's a large number of the cases in Maryland have been reversed at some point, the system more more resembles a lottery than a rational system of justice. And I think when Governor Malio said again that, you know, when you look at something that's not working and it's costing the taxpayers a lot of money, it's time to get rid of it.
Joe Cassidy, welcome back. Good to have you with us. It's been a while since you've been on the air with us.
Yeah, hi, Mark.
Always good to have you on the air with us. And talk about it from your perspective of why you think it's important to keep the death penalty alive in Maryland.
I agree with the comment that was made before. I mean, this bill really should be entitled not a bill to repeal the death penalty, but a bill to legalize certain forms of first degree murder. And I say that because a crime is defined as an act for which a punishment is imposed. And if someone who is either facing a conviction of life without parole or a life sentence, or who is serving a life sentence, commits a murder, and there is no death penalty, there is no punishment for that. If I am a gang member who is facing a trial for which I can receive for a life sentence, and I have the witnesses killed who can testify against me and send me to jail for life, what have I lost? I mean, if I'm found out, I might get a life sentence, but I might escape the life sentence by having them killed. And so, to me, the death penalty, not having the death penalty, is not a mark of respect for life. It's a mark of basically saying we don't value the victims' lives any longer. There is no penalty for killing. There is no penalty for killing the prison guard. There is no penalty for killing the witness. There is no penalty for killing the rape victim to prevent her from identifying me. So we have this whole class of murders for which there is no possible penalty. So what we have done is we have legalized murder.
Jane Henderson, let me let you jump in here. And before we go back to John Bresser. Jane, you there?
I apologize. I was on mute because I didn't want to cause any background noise. You know, I think that, you know, several levels of this. I mean, I think that, one, you know, what we've done with the 2009 law is we have made the death penalty even more arbitrary than it was before. We have basically said that certain cases, based on evidence, will be death eligible and certain cases will not. I mean, I would argue it's always been arbitrary, but we've made it even worse. Clearly, you know, this is a punishment that every study done in every state, including a very comprehensive state of Maryland, has found is more costly. A study commissioned by the Able Foundation in 2008 that looked at overall costs, and that included opportunity costs, i.e. what were prosecutors and judges and others are doing with their time, found that death cases cost three times as much as similarly aggravated capital or first-degree murder cases. And, you know, we could be putting those resources in a very different direction. The fact that we actually don't use it that much only begs the argument, then why do we continue to do it? You know, the notion that, like, you know, we're not valuing people's lives, I guess then we're saying to 99% of people who lose a loved one to murder that their family's life does not matter as much, because it's less than 1% of cases that we're actually even attempting to get the death penalty in, let alone it's probably 0.1% of those cases that get death. It's an arbitrary punishment that costs too much. I think one of the pieces of the legislation that is actually before the General Assembly right now is that it has a $500,000 appropriation that will begin in fiscal year 2015, July of 2014, and begin to put annually $500,000 in the Maryland Victims of Crime Fund specifically for services for survivors and homicide victims. I mean, let's look at our death penalty. We've had five people executed, and we have five people still sitting on death row. Those are all cases that involve black or white murder victims. All, 100%. And the vast majority, of course, of the defendants have been black. We know from Maryland's history, black kills white, that's the most likely scenario. Yet we live in a state where, as Satan talked about, the murders in Baltimore City over the last year, about 75 to 80% of homicide victims are African American. We are not taking care of victims in this state. Instead, we're throwing money against a punishment that is racially biased, expensive, and doesn't get us anything. It's time to really rethink this, and I think that that's what's happened in the legislature over the last several years, is people have rethought that, and I think that you're now starting to see a majority sentiment that's ready to move this bill. It's way past time, in my view, that we can talk about how we think certain crimes deserve the worst punishment, but the fact is that that's not how the system works. It's much, much more arbitrary. The death penalty is reserved for a handful of cases, all white victim cases, that managed to survive through years and years of process.
Mark, Joe Cassley.
Go ahead, Joe, please.
I got to respond to that. I mean, first of all, the studies that have been done have said that the death penalty is not applied in a racially disparative way. The raw data numbers don't mean anything, okay? I mean, you can throw out these.
Just a second, let me let Joe finish.
Black or whatever, that doesn't answer the question. And the cost question is that the defense, the public defenders, the people who are against the death penalty are allowed by the courts to run the cost up through ridiculous filings and motions that mean nothing. I mean, if cost is so important, and if cost is such a factor, then it seems to me that that once the death penalty is repealed, we should just save a lot of money that when the lifer kills the prison guard, we will just explain to the prison guard's family, you know what, he's already doing a life sentence. We're not going to prosecute another case just to give him another life sentence, and that'll save a lot of money.
So let me just jump in for 1 second. I want to let John Bressler kind of jump in, and then we'll come right back to Jane. John?
Yeah, sure. Well, for one thing, I think first of all, I mean the crime is about what the offender does. The punishment is how society responds to that. And if you look at the death penalty nationally and look at a bigger picture here, what you see is that over half of the executions in the United States are taking place in just three states: Texas, Virginia, and Oklahoma. And if you look even within those states, I think something like four out of two.
You potted down the wrong person.
So it's a lot of, and there have been mistakes that have been made. We know that from the Kirk Bloodsworth case in Maryland. We know that there are misidentifications, there's false confessions that occur. And so you have a system that the studies have shown across the United States and in Maryland that the death penalty tends to be imposed on in larger percentages on blacks who kill whites. And so you have a system that's racially discriminatory, incredibly arbitrary, and all those things really cut against the concepts of due process and equal protection of the law, which is what our Constitution requires.
So we're going to have Joe, let you come right back in. We're going to take a very brief break. And there are things I really want to get to in the last half an hour, which is this question of race and the death penalty, which I know, Joe, you're coming back on, and Jane wants to be heard on as well. We'll come back to that along with Delbert. And we want to come back and wrestle with the issues of just what purpose the death penalty serves or does not serve in a society. And is it a question of revenge? Is it a question of deterrence? Is it something that society needs or doesn't need? I really want to get to those two issues. And then as we come back from this break, we're going to come back within like a minute and a half. So nobody go away. 410-319-8888. Number, we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we explore the death penalty and the battle in Maryland around the death penalty in the Maryland State Legislature. On our way to this conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The number here is 410-319-8888. We are joined here this hour by Hassan Giordano, host of Reporters Roundtable. independent journalist with the Baltimore Independent Examiner, Jane Henderson, Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Against State Execution, Joe Cassidy, Harford County State's Attorney, and John Bressler, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore, and author of Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty and the Founders' Eighth Amendment, and Kiss of Death, America's Love Affair with the Death Penalty. 410-319-8888. Some of you here, the lines are open. We can get your calls coming through. We want to hear your thoughts on death penalty and what you think the issue should be and what the state legislature should do. And, Joe, I hear you wanted to make a response. Please go ahead, and then we'll jump back in with our other guests.
Well, I'm, you know, part of the problem with the death penalty opponents is they keep, in spite of what the studies really do show, they keep coming back and just saying, misstating the facts again and again, okay? Maryland had a study done on the racial application of the death penalty by the University of Maryland, all right? And although the opponents of the death penalty keep trying to say that that study showed that it was misapplied, the author of the study, Ray Paternoster, sat in front of the legislature and said, this study does not show that the death penalty in Maryland is misapplied based on race, that there is any factor of race in the application of the death penalty. And you can keep saying that again and again, but it doesn't make it true, all right? Yes, there are more blacks on death row, but you got to go beyond so many other factors. What are the crimes? What are the nature of the murder? Is the crimes even death eligible? And that all that broad, exhaustive study has been done. And repeatedly we have found that the death penalty in Maryland is not racially biased in its application, all right? So you can keep saying that, but it's not true, all right? The other problem with the cost of the death penalty is that the costs are largely run up by the defense who is opposed to the death penalty. And many of those costs are basically wasted money. And if cost is such a factor, then I think that, you know, there's no guarantee that, and I look at this, if we repeal the death penalty, we're going to give a lot of money to the victims. Well,
no,
how does that result in justice? How does that result in a finding that people are committing murders and not receiving any punishment? I mean, I don't hear the opponents of the death penalty tell me that when a lifer commits a murder of a prison guard, what are we going to do to punish him?
Okay,
there is no punish.
Let me take these things 1, 2, 3 here. And Jane, you can jump in, and John Russell back in too. And Hassan, I'm going to get you back in this as well. I'm sorry. But dealing with the issue of race, let's talk about that for a minute. Is the issue of race that more African-Americans and people of color are executed than whites for similar crimes, or is it that one study, as I read, and so the question is how you look at the data.
If I may jump in here, I think, you know, because I actually think Joe is mistaking the facts. Ray Paternoster testified for the legislature in 2003. He was the author of the study that while you could not determine any racial animus, that there was clearly a racial effect, and the main finding of the University of Maryland study, which looked at something like 123 factors and threw all those factors at the raw data and came to, you know, to do the regression analysis they did, was that it is the murder of a white Marylander that is most likely to, is about 2 to 3.5 times, depending on what part of the process you're looking at. Murder of a white Marylander was more likely to lead to a death sentence.
If
he
I can
also
jump in
concluded
too, Mark,
that
John
when you
Bessler,
have a combination
the
combination of a black defendant and a white victim, that was the most likely, and that that pattern was seen really actually early in the process. It was about whether death was sought, about whether the decision to seek death was stuck with, that went to a trial, and then actually as it moved through the jury process, it was more flat, but it wasn't corrected.
So
to say that it did not find a race effect is simply misstating the facts, and I just want to underscore that piece. Nobody can say that prosecutors are deliberately trying to only go after black murderers. This is a conscious animus, a racial, or a racist racial animus. But clearly, this race effect exists, and it's continued to exist over many years.
The only time I'm jumping in is because I want to make sure everybody gets their voice heard here, and we get this conversation on the air. John Brusser was trying to jump in, then we'll go to Hassan. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick point. I'd encourage people to take a look at the Death Penalty Information Center website, and they have statistics there about studies on race, finding that much more likely for those who kill whites to receive the death penalty. But if you look at the persons executed for interracial murders in the modern era, where you had a white defendant and a black victim, there are 19 instances of those. Where you had a black defendant and a white victim, 257 of those. So the statistics are pretty stark around the country. North Carolina and California both found that those who killed whites were over three times more likely to be sentenced to death. And again, the statistics that Jane is talking about with the study that was done are consistent with that finding of the race of the victim discrimination.
And Hassan, you can jump in here, then we'll move on to another issue and open the phones at 410-319-8888. Go ahead, Hassan.
Well, we can debate the racial factor, which I think did play a part back in the day. I can't deny that. Not dealing with the report, but when you look at the racial makeup of the defendants and the victims. However, let's move forward. I mean, Kirk Bloodsworth was exonerated because of DNA. Now, let's look at 2009 going forward. We cannot keep living in the past with these fear mechanisms. And when you look at 2009, we keep repeating it, but the law, I think, Mark, for your listeners, is basically now you have to have biological DNA evidence, a voluntarily videotaped interrogation of the defendant of that murder, or a video that conclusively links the defendant to that murder. So how many murder cases, capital punishment cases, have we had since we've strengthened the law? Since the Maryland legislature said, you know what, there is a problem, let's strengthen the law in 2009. Zero. Donut. None. Because now we have a system that says, okay, we understand the disproportionate effect it's had in the past on African Americans. We understand that people, innocent people, were not. So we're going to strengthen that to secure, to make sure that we have the best possible system in place. But again, at the end of the day, you can murder, murder, murder without the death penalty. There is no other ramifications. There is no other penalty after you get life without parole. And that is, in and of itself, to me, kind of makes me a little tepid.
Well, on our way back to Joe Cashley, what is the response then, John, if someone commits a murder while they're in prison?
Well, there's the conditions of confinement, of course. And, of course, if there's a concern that somebody would commit a murder in prison, that they can be held in more restrictive conditions of confinement. Life without parole is the preferred alternative if you look at the death penalty. There was a poll recently showed that 61% of Marylanders said that life without parole was an acceptable alternative for the death penalty. And if you look back at the history of the death penalty, which I looked at in my recent book, what you found is even a lot of the founding fathers expressed a lot of reservations about the death penalty. James Madison said he was willing to consider the experimenting with the abolition of the death penalty. Thomas Jefferson in Virginia tried to curtail the death penalty in that state. And this was before really the advent of the penitentiary system. I think a lot of people forget that, you know, when the founding fathers were putting in place the Constitution, we did not have a very well-developed prison system in the United States. The first modern penitentiary was the Walnut Street prison, and that opened in 1790. So at the same time that the Bill of Rights was about to be ratified. And, of course, over time, we've developed much more secure prisons, supermax prisons, and it's simply the case now that the death penalty is no longer necessary. We have in place around the country a very secure prison system. And when you're conducting a punishment in such an arbitrary fashion, and you see the number of executions has been declining, the number of death sentences has been declining, I think you just have to conclude that, you know, you can't just carry out an execution here or there sort of at random. When you have in the Constitution the requirements of due process and equal protection, the idea that like-minded folks will be treated alike, offenders will be treated equally. And getting rid of the death penalty allows us to not use the kind of violence that the offenders are using, but at the same time to protect the society from those violent offenders. So we don't need the death penalty any longer.
So, Joe, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mark, I can show you three other polls that over 60% of Marylanders, especially African-American as minorities, agree with the death penalty. Those are like buttholes. Everybody has them. They all stink. I think at the end of the day, even Mike Miller said, you know, even if it passes, I think that it can go to referendum. Now, that kind of questions because it's not a constitutional amendment. They don't have the votes for that. They barely had the votes for repeal. So where that goes from, if it passes the legislature, and if Mike Miller and the governor who were against the petition effort that the Republicans put last year now favor it to get death penalty, will be a whole other question.
What were you about to say, Gene? Then I'm going to turn to Joe.
Well, and you know, I hear the gentleman saying if somebody is subject to a life sentence, kills someone else, we can strengthen their conditions of confinement, which is, to me, like saying, okay, so you've murdered somebody and we're going to take dessert away and no television privileges. that ignores the issue of if you commit a crime, there should be a punishment. If there is no punishment, there is no crime. And I look back at a year and a half ago, the Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden. I didn't hear anybody crying out and saying, gee, that was terrible. What I heard was the punishment fit the crime. Okay? If there's no punishment to fit the crime, there is no justice.
So let's wrestle with this for a moment. I mean, I think one of the things you're arguing, Joe, John, is that that if a crime is committed while in prison, killing a prison guard, killing another inmate, whatever that might be, I mean, somebody could be put on 23 hours a day in the cell and 1 hour out, not allowed to see anybody in the prison. I mean, there's things you could do, as things you're suggesting. But the question is, I think we have to wrestle with, what is the purpose of the death penalty? Is it deterrent? Is it revenge? Is it to make society safer? Is it to ensure somebody pays for their life because they've taken a life? I mean, so what are we saying the death penalty is for? John, and then we go to Joe.
Well, I mean, throughout history, the people have used the death penalty, and it's over time. Like I said, the founders really were awakened to the idea of abolition through a book written by Cesare Beccaria. It was an Italian philosopher who wrote a book called On Crimes and Punishments in the 1760s, and he was the first sort of Enlightenment thinker to argue for the entire abolition of the death penalty. And his book was very popular in Europe and in the United States, was read by Thomas Jefferson, who copied different passages of that book into his commonplace book, read by James Wilson, Dr. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, argued for the abolition of the death penalty. I think the purposes of the death penalty over time have morphed, but I think the deterrence issue has sort of fallen away as the studies have shown that life without parole is an effective deterrent. But I think, you know, the other thing you have to look at here is the mistakes that are made in the system. There's been over 140 people now on death row exonerated, according to the Death Penalty Information Center in the modern era. And so, you know, the other person on the line here is basically assuming that you can make a foolproof determination of a case and never make a mistake. And that's just not the case. The studies have shown, the evidence has shown through the court system, that mistakes are made. In fact, if you look at a case in there was a case in Illinois before Illinois abolished the death penalty, where a group of undergraduate journalism students were the ones that uncovered the mistake, not the legal system, undergraduate journalism students. And if that's the kind of system that, you know, we're having, we can't afford to have a system that makes those kind of mistakes like that.
And so, Joe, just to put it on the table, because we've talked about this many times, I mean, if the death penalty is not a deterrent, then what is its purpose from your perspective?
Well, first of all, let me point out the whole issue of the mistaken person, okay? We keep talking about cases in other states. Let's talk about Maryland, okay? We don't have any problems in Maryland, and as was pointed out, the legislature has recently even tightened up the law. I mean, we talk about the application and whether people get the death penalty, but we keep looking at our statute and saying we have very limited statute for when it's even applicable. And then from an evidentiary standpoint, you have to have DNA, you have to have a videotape confession or basically an actual videotape of the crime. I don't know when that's going to occur. So let's forget what we're hearing about all these other states. Let's say from going forward now with the death penalty that we have and with the people that are on death's row that we know committed the crimes that they're there for, we have a good crime. We have a good system, all right? In terms of deterrence, I don't argue that we need the death penalty for deterrence, okay? Life imprisonment without the possibility of parole is not a deterrent, okay? No study has shown that people stop murdering other people because they're facing a life sentence, okay? So if the reason for having a punish, if the reason for getting rid of a punishment is that it doesn't act as deterrent, well, then let's just tear down prisons. We'll save billions of dollars if we tear down prisons because we've never shown that having prisons stops crime.
Jane?
I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I think that to me the issue is that our primary issue should be, our focus should be on public safety and improving public safety in every way possible and responding to victims or to violence in a way that restores victims. We know that overall that there are communities in our country and in our state that are more victimized by crime than others. And those communities are generally overserved. I also think that, you know, sure, we have narrowed our death penalty down to that, as I argued earlier, it's even more arbitrary than it's ever been. But I think that who is really missing in this equation is the victims of the families of victims, and particularly murder victims. We have guaranteed that litigation will go on for many, many more years before anyone is probably going to be executed. Three of the five men have been there for 5 years. The Maryland Commission on Capital Punishment almost unanimously voted that they, because of the process, because we have made the process tighter and take longer so we don't have a Bloodsworth, we have basically made the process longer and more difficult to the family members who at the beginning, right after murder, we promised this execution to. And I think that it's time to stop, you know, it's stop putting people through this process, setting up an expectation that is probably never going to be delivered on. You know, the commission found that life without parole was less detrimental to families. And one of the reasons is quite upfront is that it starts when you leave the courtroom. And and there may be appeals. I'm not saying there will never be appeals, but capital cases drag on for years and years and years. We've had, actually, multiple cases in which death has been sought since the law came in 2009. We've had two of those cases go to trial. It's now a three-phase process in Maryland, not a two-phase process. It's even longer. Two of those cases have gone to trial. One took 6 years to go to trial. In both cases, the jury's opted for life without parole. And we're going to keep, you know, at some point, if we keep the death penalty on the books, somebody's going to get sentenced to death, and then we'll start this whole process of litigation on the new law, because it is unique. But I would argue that it hasn't shut the window down. You know, you can confess on videotape to a crime you don't commit in a Maryland, now that becomes death eligible. I mean, in a system that is run by human beings, there is no such thing as a foolproof death penalty. And the states that have moved to repeal it have, you know, basically come to that conclusion, and that's why you've seen legislatures move. But finally, I just want to go back to, I think it should be about public safety and taking care of victims of violence to make sure that they do not, so that they can escape the cycle of violence. So we don't have children who are murder victims, have family members murdered who then go on to become perpetrators, because that's the reality now. And, you know, the death penalty is really kind of a symbolic thing that many people like to hold up, when I'd like us to take it off the table. Let's get some more oxygen in the room and let's talk about what we can really do to reduce violence and take care of victims.
So what would happen, do you think? Let me start with Joe Cassidy very quickly and then go to John Bressler. If the state legislature abolished the death penalty, how would it change the nature of, you think, your work, the nature of dealing with crime in the state of Maryland, in our society?
Well, I mean, I think the easy thing is you could just say to anyone I mean, as a prosecutor, since we keep going back to the cost and the delays, I can just tell the families of victims that have, you know, where the defendant is already subject to a life sentence, is or already going to get another life sentence, hey, you know what, I'll save us a lot of money. I won't even bother to prosecute him for the new murder because nothing else is going to happen to him. And this bit about it dragging on and dragging on, I was just in court last month for a murder that is 37 years old. I have to notify the victims' families of a murder that is 37 years old, that we're back in court again, the guy's doing a life sentence, and we're going to go back to court. I've probably got a file cabinet full of files of old murders where we keep filing new petitions and new pleadings, and I keep telling the victims, none of these are death penalty cases. All of these are life without life sentence, just simple life sentences, most of them without, not even life without parole. And I'm going to tell them again, we're back in court again. So don't give me this crud about we're worried about the victim's family.
You know,
the defense is dragging us back into court time and time and time again. And these aren't even death penalties.
Okay.
But they're not going anywhere.
So let me do this one at a time. And John, come on back in.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, for one thing, if you look at other states that have abolished the death penalty, the sky has not fallen. The criminal justice system is still operating. People who commit murders are going to prison for life. If you look at the statistics, actually, you've got, in the United States right now, you've got over 41,000 people serving a life without, true life without parole sentences. And you contrast that with the number of people on death row, which is just over 3,000. I think if you asked yourself what was the usual punishment today, you would say life without parole. And if you look at the statistics, the most, you know, the region with the most active death penalty, which is in the South, actually has the highest homicide rate. Now, there's a lot of different variables that go into that in terms of whether it's urban population or not. But there's no credible evidence that shows that the death penalty is somehow some more effective deterrent than life without parole. It's just not the case. And the society has moved towards life without parole because it allows us to protect the society at the same time that we do not ourselves have to go down into the same place to use the same sort of violence that the perpetrators are using to kill somebody. And I think that is a way to respect human rights at the same time that we're keeping the society safe. And so we need life without parole as a strong alternative to the death penalty, but you know, we no longer need to use executions in our society.
So, Joe Cassidy, do you think what we've come down to, though, then, is a question that wrestles in many ways much more with our moral, ethical viewpoint of society and the world than it does the legal question whether to have it or not?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, look, to me, this is one of these issues where the people that feel strongly against it feel strongly against it, and the people that feel for it do, and you're not going to probably get anybody to change their minds. But I think part of the problem is we talk about the death penalty working when we know, in fact, it doesn't work. I mean, the governor doesn't want to execute anybody. We talk about the fact that we've only executed 5 people in Maryland, but we've got people that are on death row that are in a position where they could have been executed had the governor wanted to follow through with his constitutional obligation to uphold the laws of the state of Maryland and move forward. I mean, there's nothing stopping us from moving forward. But, so it's very difficult to talk about the death penalty works or doesn't work when there are people in the system
one at a time
that actively don't want it to work.
And we only have like a minute left here, but one of the questions, and Jane, you can close out for us if you like. The question was, in my opinion, the death penalty is for punishment. There are people who view that solitary confinement as torture, so if death penalty and solitary confinement are removed, how do you punish someone that has taken a life?
You know, I think that anyone who's involved in corrections will tell you that prison can be horrible, downright horrible, or just god-awful. And there is no question in my mind that someone who commits a violent act in prison, particularly against a prison guard, is going to
suffer consequences in the institution and is going to be isolated and is going to lose, you know, to say they'll lose dessert and TV, they'll lose contact visits with family, they'll lose phone calls. You know, I think that prisons, what keeps prison staff safe is not a death penalty. I think it's a red herring that's being thrown up right now. It's proper staffing. It's an adequate facilities. You know, we have seen a de-escalation in prison violence since the House of Corrections was shut down, which is where the last prison guard was killed in our...
Jane, I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but we are literally plumb out of time here, and it's been a really fascinating discussion from all these sides. Jane Henderson, who just heard, is the Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Against State Execution, Joe Cassidy, Harford County State's Attorney, John Bruster, before that, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore, who's written the books Cruel and Unusual, The American Death Penalty, and The Founder's Eighth Amendment, and the book Kiss of Death, America's Love Affair with the Death Penalty, Hassan Giordano, who is a host of Reporters Roundtable and writes for the Baltimore Independent Examiner. Earlier, Delbert Tibbs, who served, who was a death row inmate and found innocent. I want to thank all of you for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion, and we'll see where we go with it all.
Thanks.
Thank
you.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
On the way out the door, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information available at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mafronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of King Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about our guests and their work, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.